They determined that Lloyd Jarwers participated in the conspiracy, but that others, including government agencies, also participated.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was the media's reaction to the verdict?
Silence. The media's reaction to most things has been silence. There was one article in the New York Times, and then it went away. The media stayed in the hallway through most of the trial, not hearing the evidence. When Mrs. King testified, or Andrew Young, or Dexter, they came in, took note of that testimony. But when the real hard evidence was being presented, they were, for the most part, not capable, not willing to report it. So the American people, most American people don't even know the trial took place.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Pepper. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King with attorney William Pepper, author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King.
This is Ken McDermott Rowe, host of History Counts. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, an edition of the monthly series History Counts, which originates at WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The program, produced by MDR Productions, Incorporated, was hosted by Ken McDermott Rowe and engineered by David Schwartz. Sprouts is distributed by and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Coming up next on Free Radio, Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Today is April 4th, 2008. And special guest Robert Letterman of Artist will be joining us in about 5 minutes. Stay tuned.
This song is about the sort of things your mother says to you when you're not going away to college, but when you're a child. To keep you from bodily harm. It's called Don't Put It in Your Mouth. Don't put it in your mouth. You don't know where it's been. Don't assume it's candy for a minute. Don't take it from the ground or from a strange old man. Other kids have vanished when they did it. Don't bring it in the house because it's not a toy. Don't you ever point it at your sister. Go put it in your room. I'll wash your mouth with soap. Then I'll put you to in separate corners. Did you bring enough for everyone? Keep it to yourself or share or share. Go upstairs and think of what you've done. You're just not my kid. I swear, I swear, I swear, I swear. Don't swing that thing around. You just might poke an eye. Wipe that grin before it sticks forever. Don't leave it on the floor or feed it to the dog. If you want to grow up healthy, knock it off and put it down. Keep it clean and safe for later. And don't you put it in your mouth. Don't put it in your mouth. What if you should choke, even though you didn't choke the last time?
you jump right off the bridge. Because the neighbor did, you should try to make your brain work sometime. Let me see your hands, both sides. Stop that slipping now and blow and blow. What is best for you is best for me. Don't ask why or how, just go, just go, 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 just go. If you don't want to eat, we'll find someone who will. Starving kids in India will love it. And you'll just go to bed and stay there for a week, or put it in your mouth and swallow it. How many times do I have to tell you?
In one ear and out the other.
Don't try talking with your mouth full.
Your father.
If you want to grow up healthy, knock it off and put it down. Keep it clean and safe for later. And don't you put it in your mouth. Knock it off.
And that was Uncle Banzai from their CD Plain Brown Wrapper, Unreleased Songs, 1984 to 1989. Some people will take you back to the 60s. It's back to the 80s on this show, or the late 80s anyway. Aha! And this could be a call in the middle of 2008, or actually in the spring anyway. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Can you hear me? Hello? Hang on a second here.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me? Hello? Hello, can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay, it looks like, Robert, we have a bad line on this phone line. Let me give you a second number to call in on. Exactly so. Thanks. And that's the second time this has happened. Our 469-3119 line, which was working pretty well a couple weeks ago. It doesn't seem to be working now, but the other line is, or at least I hope so. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey.
Robert?
Yes.
Hey. Well, you're live, and I guess I should introduce you, shouldn't I?
That would be good.
Well, I am talking with none other than Robert Letterman, who is he, are you chair, co-founder, Fuhrer, or just plain old first citizen of artist?
Well, I'm the elected president of Artists, and I was definitely a co-founder.
All right. That's Artists' response to illegal state tactics, right?
That's it.
And that's a group that's been in New York City for how many years now?
We were founded at the end of 1993, so that's about 14 years.
What prompted your founding?
Well, I was a street artist since I was 12 years old. And like a few hundred other artists in New York City, I sold my art on the street, which for most of my life wasn't really a problem with the police. Then when Rudy Giuliani got elected mayor, all of a sudden he launched a crackdown on street artists, had every one of us arrested numerous times, had our artwork confiscated and destroyed, and that led us to form a group to fight for our rights.
And Giuliani was elected, what, for two terms in the 90s?
Right. He served from 94 through 2001.
So you actually founded it right before he got elected?
We founded it because during the election, see, in New York City, whenever there's an election, there's usually a police crackdown on all kinds of things to try to make the incumbent look good. So the crackdown actually started at the very end of the Dinkins administration, David Dinkins.
Mm-hmm.
And but it didn't really get off the ground until maybe the second month of Giuliani being in office.
Now, I know in other cities when they crack down on homeless people with downtown business districts, pulling in private security guards and launching their give them a hand in the face, not a handout or something, campaign, don't give away money to panhandlers. And this often includes street musicians and street performers. It often can have to do with redeveloping an area of that town, which previously had been considered, you know, a slum. Now they want to upgrade it into a condo area. Is that what happened in New York City at all, or was it a different kind of process?
It was a very different kind of dynamic. Not surprisingly, the artists were certainly not selling in the slum areas of New York, of which there are quite a few. They were selling in the more upscale areas because it would be impossible to make any money in the economically depressed areas. What this really was about then and what it's still about today, you mentioned business improvement districts. These corporate interests have their own designs on what they would like to do with the public spaces of the cities. In New York City, that includes the streets and the parks. They want to use them basically for advertising and promotional purposes. And the problem that the city has is, how can we sell these public spaces to corporations if people like street artists can use them for free based on First Amendment free speech? So in other words, in order to make this commodity, in other words, to commodify public space, you have to basically make it inaccessible to the public and then sell it to people that can put up the money that the city wants to get for that space. In the parks, just to give an example of the way this works, the only people selling anything in any park in New York City that aren't paying huge sums of money to do it are street artists, and that's because of one of the lawsuits that we won.
What's the name of that lawsuit, by the way?
Letterman et al. V. Giuliani.
Is that a Letterman that we may have heard of before?
Yes, that's me.
Okay. Congratulations.
Other people who sell there pay as much as $750,000 for a vending spot. So you could see the juxtaposition of somebody pays $750,000 for this 8-foot spot, and right next to him there's an artist selling there for free. Obviously, this limits the city's ability to make this a desirable spot to sell. And they wanted to do this on the streets. As far back as the late 80s, there were proposals to make a vending concession system on the streets of New York. The big obstacle to it, again, was the street artists, because as long as people could be there for free, it makes it hard to sell the same spot to somebody else for a vast sum of money. And the city's idea of how to solve the problem was to get rid of the artists, to declare it illegal to sell art on the street, to arrest us all. They hoped that we would be intimidated after a few arrests and give up. And to their surprise, and I think to ours as well, the opposite happened. We became suddenly First Amendment advocates. I got elected as president of the group after the first meeting. I knew nothing about the law, and I certainly wasn't any kind of activist at that time. Went to the public library, looked up the First Amendment, saw some texts of rulings from federal lawsuits about First Amendment rights, and I realized, hey, wait a second, these court cases are saying that the streets are the ultimate First Amendment forum.
Now, the federal First Amendment, for those who don't know it, is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor abridging the freedom of the speech or the press or the people's right to peaceably assemble. I missed a few words, but I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah. And
just thought I'd let people know. We often use the words First Amendment, but some of us aren't, you know, don't have it immediately at hand. So.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing that you took that tack there, because one of the things that shocked me most about this whole process was that when we got into federal court, the judge presiding over the case didn't know the First Amendment either, and actually had in the very beginning of the oral arguments asked one of the lawyers if they had a copy of it. and the irony of this was that this judge had been the lawyer for the Museum of Modern Art before she had become a federal judge. So not only was she presumably supposed to be an expert in the First Amendment, but she was also specifically an expert in the application of the First Amendment to art. And she had no idea that it actually protected art. And in fact, in her ruling, which was later overturned, she declared that art was not protected by the First Amendment. And in fact, what her ruling said was, basically, there is no difference between a painting and the design on a piece of silverware. It's simply a decoration, and therefore it doesn't communicate anything, so it's not protected by the First Amendment. A couple of years later, she was overturned by the appeals court. That case went to the Supreme Court. We won. And that was the case that basically established the idea for the first time that an artist was protected by the First Amendment, not only when they were making a painting, but when they were selling a painting on the street.
So Letterman et al. Versus Giuliani was that case?
No, that was a subsequent case. The first case was Letterman et al. The City of New York, and it was combined with another case by members of the same group called Berry et al. The City of New York. That's the case that first established the right. Letterman et al. V. Giuliani, right after we won the first case, we got rid of the license requirement for selling art on the street. The city immediately instituted a permit requirement in parks as a way to basically subvert the ruling we had won.
Just in parks or in the city generally?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Just in parks or in the city generally? Did they, in other words, when you won the abolition of the license requirement, was the new permit requirement citywide or was it just in parks?
It was in parks, but in New York City, parks are all over the city, and the Parks Department claims a vast amount of public space even outside of the parks. Just to give you an example, the Parks Department claims everything within 500 feet of a park. So, for example, Central Park, which is 800 and something acres, on one of its borders is Fifth Avenue. 500 feet from the park, you have two more avenues, Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue, some of the most valuable real estate on the planet. The Parks Department claims ownership for the purposes of administration over all of that territory and claim that artists that were even a block and a half or two blocks from the park had to get a permit. So basically that permit requirement reinstituted a licensing scheme for the whole city. Took us 7 more years to win that case through all the different appeals.
You know, that we have a similar situation in Santa Cruz. The Santa Cruz Parks and Rec claims the right to close, not even by a city council vote or by a vote of the Parks and Rec Commission, but by the unilateral actions of Danette Shoemaker, our Parks and Recreation czar alone, any area, including City Hall, where traditionally there have been protests at night and protests, you know, to I'm particularly interested in the ones that criminalize poor people, this sleeping ban law we have in Santa Cruz. So I guess it's not just New York City. Is this a procedure that went through a legislative process in New York City, or did it get done through a bureaucratic ruling or edict? And I guess in addition to that question, you've gone to the courts and gotten vindication there. Have you ever gotten vindication through a legislative body, like through council people or the state legislature or something like that?
Well, to answer both your questions, no, they never had passed a law that required artists to get a license or a permit. They simply made it a policy. And the answer to your second question is no, we definitely have not gone to the legislature because in our experience, and I think other people that go through this will find the same thing, the legislators work for the exact same business interests that are trying to get rid of the artists and get rid of the First Amendment rights on public property. So going to those people and saying, can you make a law enforcing our First Amendment rights on public property, it creates a conflict for them. They get their campaign money basically from real estate interests and business interests. And no amount, I mean, even if there were a million street artists, they're never going to equal the buying power of even a single corporation. So we've deliberately avoided ever going to the legislature and asking them to create a law for us. What we do deal with the legislature in New York, the city council, but we basically focus on preventing them from making any new laws. And in fact, that brings us right up to today, because there's a proposed law that's being worked on right now by a council member, the council member for Soho, Alan Gerson, who is now, 14 years later, still trying to take away all the rights that we've won.
Why don't you talk about that? Say what the current situation is. I guess it's regarding, what, street vendors?
It's a vending law, and street artists are also subject to various parts of the vending law. Basically, the lawsuits that we won exempted us from a license or a permit requirement. It didn't eliminate size and placement on the street restrictions. So, for example, there's a 60-page long vending ordinance in New York. It consists of basically different layers of vending law that have been added over the past 100 years in New York City, and that restrict the size of a vending display, what section of the sidewalk you could put it on, how far it could be from a corner, how many feet wide the sidewalk has to be in order to make vending legal, things like that. And street artists are subject to most of those rules. The many people that hear about this issue, they mistakenly think that we, as street artists, as members of the group artists, are asking to be able to do anything we want, to have no restrictions of any kind, and that's not true. We simply want to be free from a licensing requirement or a permit or any particular test that we would have to pass or panel that we would have to submit the work to. We're not really objecting to there being reasonable, what in legal terms are called time, place, and manner restrictions. And that's because these restrictions exist in all First Amendment issues. The classic example is you can't yell fire in a movie theater even though you have free speech. So we're not looking to escape all regulation. We're simply looking to be exempt from regulation that would seriously impinge on the freedom part of First Amendment rights.
And do the current New York regulations so impinge? I mean, would you be seeking a liberalization of those laws at the same time as Councilmember Gerson is seeking a restriction?
Well, we're realists. I mean, we would certainly like to see somewhat of a loosening of the laws. Just to give a specific example so you'll know what I mean, there's a restriction that a table can only, that a vending display, and that includes an art display, can only be 8 feet in length. We'd love to see a 10 feet. It's not a major issue. There's another restriction that you have to be 20 feet from a door. We think that's a bit excessive. 15 feet from a door would be more reasonable. But by and large, given those objections to some of the details, the vending laws that exist are fairly reasonable. They work fairly well. They not only protect our rights, but they protect the rights of pedestrians and business owners and property owners. And if you come to New York, you'll see probably about 2,000 artists selling their work on the street, and it's a pretty harmonious situation. It works well for the artists, works well for the tourists and the residents, and there's really no need to change the system that exists now unless you're trying to basically eliminate the freedom completely or eliminate the people that are using this right. In other words, take what I call privatizing public space, where you take the right away from the people and you transfer it over to corporations and business interests.
How do artists deal with conflicts between each other? I mean, what if a street performer, I don't know, does this include street performers or just people vending their art are we talking about?
Well, when I'm saying street artists, I'm specifically talking about visual artists, because that's what my group is about. There are certainly many street performers in New York and probably 15,000 vendors who are not selling art. Keep in mind, this is a city of 8 million people. Mm-hmm. It's very big. There's tens of thousands of streets in New York. So when somebody hears a number, there's 10 or 15,000 vendors. Certainly compared to your city, that sounds like a huge number. But actually, just to give you an example comparatively, there are 45,000 taxis in New York. So compared to that, 10 or 15,000 vendors is really a drop in the bucket. And I'm not going to say that there's never any conflicts between vendors or artists or street performers, but basically the whole thing works out fairly well.
How do you work out these things? We used to have in Santa Cruz a thing called the Voluntary Street Performers Guidelines, where we kind of had an informal agreement that if you got a complaint that, you know, somebody wanted to use your space or a merchant was going batty hearing the same tune, and again, this is more about street performers, and we don't have vendors because Santa Cruz laws ban vendors without a license, something that I think we could use your court decision to attack and probably should. But we have this voluntary system. When vendors have a dispute, how do you deal with it? I mean, does the organization come in and mediate? Do they work it out themselves? Do they call the cops? What happens?
All of the above.
Uh-huh.
There's no particular system that we use. Again, I'm telling you that there's 15,000 or so
right.
vendors in
mm-hmm.
New York, so my group is hardly in a position to go out there and resolve every single conflict. Mm-hmm. Even the police department would have a hard time doing that. But the reality is that not that those conflicts never take place, they do, but the people on the street basically work it out amongst themselves fairly harmoniously. Occasionally there's a fight, but that can happen over a seat on the subway or a parking spot, and certainly happens a lot more about a parking spot than it does about a vending spot. So considering that there's no official rules about how to resolve those disputes, I've certainly put out over the past 14 years many suggestions to people and exhortations about this is the way it would be good to resolve these things, but there's no set system for doing that, and despite that, it all pretty much works out. Again, because it's such a big city, even with all the vending and performing that takes place here, if you have a situation where somebody's cramping your style, there's 1,000 other streets you could go to and do the same thing. So that relieves the pressure. If this was a city where there was basically just one or two commercial strips where this was possible, then certainly there would be a lot more problems than there are in that regard.
Now, when you talk about this 20,000 artists selling their work, is that in Manhattan or the entire...
I would say about 2,000 artists.
I'm sorry, 2,000
artists. Maybe 15,000 vendors altogether.
Yeah, I added an extra zero, sorry about that. So, but that's in Manhattan, or that's the broader, five-borough area?
Well, the majority sell in Manhattan because that's certainly where the money is, but mm-hmm. there are certainly hundreds of artists in Queens, the Bronx, Brooklyn. I'm not aware of any selling on the street in Staten Island, but there could well be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in every one of these boroughs, for example, obviously, if you're a tourist and you come to New York, you're basically going to come to Manhattan.
Manhattan, of course, for those who don't know New York City, is the island around which the other kind of boroughs are located as part of the mainland, right?
Right. But, you know, Manhattan has 2 million people that live there. Brooklyn, for example, much bigger, has over 5 million people live there. And there are commercial strips in Brooklyn that are every bit as big and prosperous as Fifth Avenue in New York City. And the interesting thing is New York is so, New Yorkers tend to be quite provincial, as are people in other parts of the country. There are many people in Brooklyn that have never been to Manhattan, even though it's a, you know, 20-minute subway ride away. So there are pockets of intense vending activity in each of the five boroughs. Fulton Street in Brooklyn is a big one. Queens Boulevard in Queens, the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. These are all localized commercial strips where there are many vendors and some street artists working. But there's no question that the vast majority of the members of artists in New York sell in Manhattan.
We're talking with Robert Letterman of artists' response to illegal state tactics, a group that he and others formed in 1993 that is fighting new regulations by City Council member Gerson, which are coming up for a vote. Is that what's happening now? There's a change being planned?
Well, it's not up to a vote yet. We're trying to defeat it before it's even presented.
Uh-huh.
We find that. See, the way the City Council works, sort of like the Congress, like when the Congress passed the Patriot Act, they didn't even read it. They were told to pass it. They mm-hmm. did. That's how the City Council works. So if you wait to the point where they're getting ready to vote on it, you already lost. So we try to defeat it while the council member is in his office with a couple of lawyers writing the bill. We talk to them. I talk to them. I got them to send me an advance copy of it. I wrote a very detailed critique of it. I sent it back to the council member and his staff. I also, and this wasn't what they had in mind, I gave it out to 2,000 street artists, and they all sent the council member letters denouncing this bill. And so we're looking to basically discourage him from going forward. And we have reason to believe we can succeed in that. We've done it 5 different times before in the past few years, after we had won these lawsuits, previous times that they tried to create new legislation to take away the rights we had won. We defeated it each time before it ever came to a vote before the whole City Council.
And what exactly are the restrictions that the bill would put in place?
Well, it'd be a radical change. It would, right now, just to give you an example of the situation, let's say, Robert, that you come to New York, you're a painter, you just got off the Greyhound bus, you don't have a penny in your pocket, you got 5 paintings under your arm. You could set up on the street, just about any street in New York, and start selling. It's as simple as that. What this new proposed law wants to do, it wants to make you have to enter a lottery to win a vending spot. It wants to cut down the number of spots by something like, I would estimate, 90%. It wants to put a vast space between vendors and between street artists, apart from all the other time, place, and manner restrictions that exist. It wants to close different streets on certain days of the week, very arbitrarily. And ultimately, what the purpose of this law is, it also involves marking off all these vending spots and quantifying them as a preparation to selling them by a concession system. So this would be a total radical change in the present system. And if Council Member Gerson's law were to pass, it would basically be killing anything that resembled First Amendment freedom in the vending scene in New York City. So we're as against this bill as it's possible to be. There's not a single detail of it that we approve of.
Is this a bill identical to the previous 5 attempts, or is it significantly
different? No, it's actually worse. The previous attempts, they tried to reinstitute the license and the permit, but not to make these other restrictions. We oppose the whole idea of a license or permit, which, if you'll allow me, I'll run that down to your audience. I'm sure some of them would understand this without me explaining, but a lot of people don't understand it. They say, well, I need a license to drive my car. Why wouldn't you need a license to sell art? And it goes like this. The whole idea of the First Amendment says Congress, the government, shall make no law restricting or abridging freedom of speech. And what could be more of a restriction or an abridgment than to make you go to a city agency and apply for a license to speak? Now, if you're going to drive a car, there's a very good reason why you have to get a license. Even a good driver can have an accident, can destroy property, can kill somebody. If you have a bad accident, you could run over 20 people in one accident. There's no reason for a street artist to have to get a license in that regard. Even the dumbest, clumsiest street artist, it's hard to imagine a scenario where they're going to kill anybody. And also, more significantly, in terms of the free speech issue, the requirement for you to go and apply for a license or a permit takes the possibility of spontaneity completely out of the equation. So let's say, just to make an example, President Bush is going to come to New York tomorrow, and I want to make a painting critical of President Bush, or let's make it really far-fetched. I want to make a painting supporting President Bush. He's the greatest president in American history. I want to go out there on Fifth Avenue. I heard he's coming there, and I want to hold up that painting so he could see it. But if I have to go and apply for a permit or a license, if I have to enter a lottery to win a spot, it's impossible for me to be able to do that in time for him to get there and see that painting. So basically, my free speech has been made impossible by that regulation.
Devil's advocate would say, well, this wouldn't prevent you from making the painting in your own home and then bringing it out on the street and holding it and while he passes by in his parade, right? That would not be the same thing as holding it up for sale.
Well, the fact is that not only in my cases, but many cases, the Supreme Court has ruled that selling some form of free speech is no different at all than offering it for free. So, and the reason that they came to that understanding, to use newspapers, let's say, as an example, that clearly newspapers are protected by free speech, and at the same time, most newspapers are for sale. The reason that they defend a publisher's right to sell a newspaper exactly equal to, let's say, you or I making a leaflet and giving it out for free, is that to finance the printing presses and buy giant rolls of paper and hire trucks to deliver the newspapers and writers to write the articles, it's going to take a lot of money. And if you can't sell the newspaper, you're never going to make the newspaper, so basically you would have no free speech. That's why selling something protected by the First Amendment is exactly as protected as giving it away or simply displaying it.
I'm sympathetic to that argument, but I think to claim that it, you know, the guy jumps off the bus and wants to protest the president by showing a painting of his, that, you know, your spontaneous right to show something is not, at least as I understand it from what you, how you describe the regulation, taken away by that. But you're, perhaps you're right to set up a vending stand to pass on other paintings to other people at the same time as a, or to make them available for sale. And this is as a political demonstration as the president goes by. I guess that would be restricted. I'm being very picayune with you, but I'm.
Well, I could tell you this, Robert. You know, we've talked over the years. As you know, I have been arrested over 40 times, and most of those arrests involved me doing nothing more than holding up a single painting of Mayor Giuliani. It wasn't for sale. I had no table. I had nothing for sale. I was standing with one painting, and I was arrested each of those times for it.
But you were never convicted, right?
The reality is that when these restrictions are put in place in a city, they're often very broadly applied, even if that wasn't what was in the text when it was written or when the legislators were thinking of it. These laws are then used to silence non-commercial speech as well as commercial speech.
Now, were you arrested under the old laws or under other sort of opportunistic or statutes of the moment, or, you know, disturbing the peace or slander?
Well, they basically threw in every conceivable thing,
right,
from disturbing the peace, obstructing the sidewalk, inciting a riot, destroying property, selling without a license, you name it. I've been charged with it. And by the way, never once convicted of a single charge.
Good lawyer, or did you defend yourself?
A mixture. I defended myself in many cases. I also had some good lawyers, and I also had some real bad lawyers.
So, I guess you have a lot of people who are, a lot of artists who are sending in letters, emails, and so forth, but you're, again, going up against a very large corporate, presumably profit-making machine that the city wants to milk, and yet five times before you're able to defeat them. Is this because you're, you know, sleeping with the mayor's wife, or what's going on here?
Well, you know, what I believe in doing is using what you can. So while the corporations have the monetary power, we have the power to embarrass them. And I spend a lot of time analyzing the situation, planning a strategy, looking for their weak points. One of the weak points that I discovered about these corporate interests is that they use the arts, this is a phrase that I coined, as a cultural cover story. Just to give you an example, the very same corporations and organizations in New York that are known to be the greatest advocates for the arts, I'm talking about the Fifth Avenue Bid, Chase Manhattan Bank, Exxon Mobil, which has its corporate headquarters here, the Central Park Conservancy, the Soho Alliance. These groups use as propaganda the idea that they're fantastic advocates for the arts. So we use that to embarrass them. We have protests, we have these letter-writing campaigns, and we bring to the public's attention, often through the media, the irony that these famous art advocates, Mike Bloomberg is probably the greatest example. This is a multi-billionaire, probably, I can't think of anybody except John D. Rockefeller, who has contributed more money to the arts than Mike Bloomberg. At the same time, Mike Bloomberg has been trying to take away street artists' rights from his very first day in office. But we've used that.
He's the mayor, right?
Right. He'd like to be the president, but hopefully that doesn't happen. We've managed to leverage his own self-made reputation as an art advocate against him to prevent him from going forward on getting these laws passed. Same with Alan Gerson. He's the council member from Soho. I'm sure your listeners have heard of Soho. It's the most famous art district in the world, certainly in America. At the same time that he's the head of this art district, he's trying to take away street artists' rights. And when we bring that information to the public, it generally causes him to back down on what he's trying to do.
What means have you used to bring this to the public? You've mentioned writing letters and editorials. Do you have anything like public protests, engage in any guerrilla theater, any civil disobedience? What can you give us some idea of how these last five attempts were defeated and how the current one is likely to be defeated?
Well, the group Artist has staged well over 250 protests over the years, and these protests have gotten massive media coverage. I mean, I've been in the New York Times maybe 45 different times, been in Newsweek, People Magazine, you name it, every news show. We've had the front page of New York newspapers on a couple of occasions. In fact, one of my anti-Giuliani paintings showed up on the front page of the Sunday New York Times a few months ago when he was still running. And we've also done many very small actions where we'll show up outside a council member's office or the mayor's office. We'll time these actions to be at the maximum point of effectiveness. So, for example, just to make an example, when Giuliani was still mayor, let's say he was going to do a press conference about donating some money to an art museum. That's the time we'd show up there with our signs and our leaflets. And by picking exactly the right moment and going for the vulnerability of these elected officials to bad publicity, it can be very effective. It can even be effective by one person. I've done this myself, and I've seen other artists in other cities do some street theater just as a single individual. Sometimes if you play it right, you call up the media ahead of time so that they're there to cover the story, even one person can become an effective protest if it's done at the right time, in the right place, and in the right way.
Has the media become less sympathetic, more sympathetic over the years? What's the situation been with that?
Much less. You know, part of the thing is the consolidation of the media. When we started this group, there were more newspapers in New York than there are now. They were all individually owned. Every TV station had its own news shows, independent of each other. They've all been consolidated. Rupert Murdoch owns half the newspapers in New York now, and he lives in Soho. He hates street artists. You know, there was a time when we could get on the evening news just about any night of the week by simply sending a fax to the news desks of each of the networks. That the chances of getting on the evening news now, unless something incredibly dramatic were to take place, is virtually zero. And it's not just my group that has experienced that. There were, when we started this group, protests were on TV every night from lots of groups, whatever the issue was, animal rights, gay rights, women's rights. You don't see very many protests on TV anymore. A protest has to have 500,000 people to even make the news, or you have to do something really outrageous, like, you know, try to grab the elected official or jump in front of his car or something, and even then you probably won't get on the news. So getting the media to work for you is a much harder thing to do today than it was 5 or 10 years ago, but it's certainly not impossible.
Now, is, should say, pieing still a method used against some politicians?
I haven't seen it lately. In fact, I know Aaron Kay, the pie man who made that famous, but I haven't seen him do a pie in a long time. And frankly, nowadays they'd probably arrest you under the Patriot Act for attacking an official with a whipped cream pie.
Terrorism.
It's a lot more risky than it used to be.
Well, you never could tell. The cream is not good for you. It's cholesterol. Yeah, it could be dangerous. So, is there anything people who are here in Santa Cruz can do to support artists? We're talking with Robert Letterman of Artist. Give me the acronym, or not the acronym, give me the long version of Artist.
Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics. Well, anybody that would like to get Alan Gerson's address and a copy of his proposal and would like to send him a letter, they can just send me an email. I'll give you my email address. It's artistprez, ArtistPres, at gmail.com. And I'll send you the information, and I would love to have you write to him and let him know what you think of it.
Huh.
I would also encourage any artists listening to me in their cities to look up our lawsuits, look up the rulings, and bring the same kind of lawsuit in your city, because there are millions and millions of artists in this country. Most of them are starving artists, partly because or largely because they can't show anybody their work because they can't get in a gallery. Well, guess what? The whole country is your gallery. The United States Constitution gives you the right to use your art just the same way somebody would use a newspaper or a leaflet. And it's not that hard to win these lawsuits, especially if people sell newspapers on the street in your city. You can win this same lawsuit where you live.
Would you like to talk just a little bit about how this lawsuit has impacted other cities? You probably have gotten the word from other places that have successfully pressed their own lawsuits. And I know earlier we spoke, and it was rather, you were rather gloomy about the prospects of more liberal laws and attitudes and policies towards artists in cities generally across the country, and who knows, maybe even across the first world, you know, across the industrialized world, because you were telling me that without judicial action, you don't have cities that said that out of the beneficence of their city council decide, hey, we're going to have some real liberal rules, as far as you know. You want to talk a little bit about the situation nationally and the impact of your decision on those cities that have tried to take up that particular decision to get their own freedoms ratified?
Well, there are a small number of cities where artists have taken our legal precedents and either convinced their city officials to allow artists to sell on the street or have sued them and won. Salt Lake City is probably the most interesting example. An artist there brought a copy of the ruling in our first lawsuit to the local mayor, whose name I don't recall, frankly, I'm sorry to say. And that mayor was so struck by the rightness of it that he got a law passed that artists could sell on the street in Salt Lake City, which is a pretty conservative place. And I think that indicates that it's not impossible to convince city officials to go along with this even without a lawsuit. Other cities, artists have brought these lawsuits. Some have been successful, some aren't. There are some pending cases right now. An artist named Steve White has a case that's just been appealed to the United States Supreme Court. He had won, and that was, I think, in Nevada. And he won the right to sell on the street, and the Corporation Counsel for the city just filed an appeal in the U.S. Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court heard the appeal, which is possible, maybe unlikely, and they ruled in his favor, that would resolve this whole issue for all 50 states. And frankly, you know, when you really look at this issue from the big picture point of view, the very municipalities that are cracking down on artists at the same time are spending millions of dollars on the arts. They're giving artists grants. They're putting up art museums, opera houses, all kinds of places for people to do arts under the guise of promoting tourism and so on. Nothing. It doesn't take any money to promote the arts. All it takes is to let artists have the First Amendment rights that the Constitution already gives them, and you can make a great tourist attraction without spending a single penny. And not only is it a tourist attraction and something that helps the artists, but frankly, anywhere that there are street artists, you're helping businesses in the area, restaurants, clothing stores, jewelry stores, and even art galleries, directly benefit from the kind of foot traffic that artists bring. I'll give you an interesting footnote to this that'll illustrate what the effect of not only artists but even vending is on other businesses. If you go to almost any mall in the United States, you'll find that despite the fact that the stores in that mall rent out for very large sums of money, that after the mall opens, usually a few years afterwards, they introduce vending carts in the hallways, the pathways, the pedestrian byways that go through that mall. Because they've found, by doing studies, that consumers will go into the stores and buy more if they see vending carts, even pseudo-vending carts. They're not really push carts, but they often make them look like old-time push carts. That for some psychological reason, this stimulates people to be more excited about buying products. So even in a very private kind of venue like a mall, they find the need to introduce the equivalent of sidewalk vending as a way to stimulate purchases by pedestrians that go through there. The same thing in New York City. Many people who have stores in the areas where there are street artists and even where there are just regular vendors actually want to keep the vendors there. And in some cases where there's been a big crackdown and the vendors were eliminated, and the perfect example is 125th Street in Harlem. This is one of the most famous cultural spots in the United States. For African Americans, it's the most famous cultural spot. In 1998, Mayor Giuliani had every vendor. There was a huge number of African-American street vendors that worked on 125th Street. Had them all arrested, had them all completely eliminated. Within 6 months, half the stores on that street went out of business because rather than competing with them, the vendors were actually bringing a majority of the business to the area. And since then, they've actually allowed many of those vendors to come back. They never changed the law back, but they allowed them to come back because the stores themselves were asking the city to do that. So I think there are good aspects to this and bad as far as what the future could hold, but I think in terms of the specific issue of street artists, if artists take the time to understand what their rights really are, and those rights are very strong. It's the strongest right that the Constitution gives us is the First Amendment. That's why they made it the First Amendment. They didn't make it the 27th Amendment or the 15th Amendment. They made it the very first. And it's the hardest one for cities to get rid of, no matter how much they want to. And this is the right that gives artists this opportunity to sell on the street.
What's the racial makeup of your organization? Were a lot of those vendors who were driven away after arrest in 1998, did they join artists? Do you have a strong showing of Hispanic and Native American and, I don't know, Asian American artists?
Well, our group is literally like a United Nations. And, you know, part of it is because it's New York City. This is the immigrant capital of the United States. So we have members literally from virtually every country. Caucasians are, at this point, a minority in our group. There's people from every corner of the world. Just to take an example, Tibet. There's probably 300 artists just from Tibet in our group. And that's a fairly obscure place in New York City, Tibet. Latin America, Africa, every country in Europe, they all have many members of artists on the street from those countries selling their art. And it's a fantastic thing, and it's a very hopeful thing to see people from such diverse cultures getting along and displaying their diverse forms of artwork on the street. It's great for the artists. It's great for the public.
You mentioned that this mass elimination of artists happened at 125th in 1998. It's 10 years later. The laws are the same. Has artists been successful, or has it been asked, or have you guys gotten together to restore the rights of artists up there, or is it, you know, is there a cultural divide, or is it, what's happened with that?
No, there's no cultural divide. You'll find many African-American artists selling on 125th Street right now if you went there on a nice day. You know, like in any city, you'll find that there are laws, and then there are the laws that are enforced. So, for example, prostitution is completely illegal in New York. There's probably 500,000 professional prostitutes in New York City who have their own ad in the Yellow Pages. It's nothing hidden. The police pretty much ignore it. Drug dealing is illegal. There's probably a million people making their living dealing drugs in this city. A lot of them get arrested, but the vast majority do their thing every day. Vending without a license, if you're not an artist, it's illegal in New York. There's 10,000 illegal vendors. They all get arrested once in a while, but for each individual, they might go 2 or 3 years without being arrested or ever seeing a cop. So the reality is that regardless of what the laws are, this activity goes on throughout the city. It's because of the economic need. It's not because people are trying to break the law. The licenses aren't available. Most of these illegal vendors would get a license if there was one. There's only 853 vending licenses for the whole city of 8 million people. So it's not hard to see why there's so many illegal vendors. But frankly, no matter how hard the city would crack down, they'll never get rid of vending. They've been trying consistently for over 100 years in New York City. You can go back to the archives of the New York Times 100 years ago, and you'll find articles that are virtually word for word identical to vending articles and editorials that are published this year in the same paper. We have to get rid of these vendors. They're destroying the city and making everything dangerous and competing with businesses and destroying property values. It's the exact same story 100 years ago.
But now you're a terrorist threat, Robert.
Well, I have been called a terrorist. No. I certainly don't see myself as a terrorist. I see myself as a patriot. I'm defending the Constitution of the United States. I don't do anything violent, and frankly, I don't even find the need to do civil disobedience. I'm doing civil obedience. I'm obeying the Constitution. The city officials, the elected officials that are violating the Constitution, to my point of view, these are the terrorists, and we're opposing them, but we're doing it by nonviolent means, usually by very loving and even affectionate means. At least that's the way I would describe
it. Did you ever hug Rudy, or has that not happened yet?
I've shaken it. I've shook his hand. I've sat with him in a room for 8 hours in a deposition of my court case. And I don't know anybody who could tell you that besides
Well,
me.
You didn't give him a back rub, did you?
Not exactly, but I worked him over pretty good over the years.
What about the effects of the economic depression that we are sliding into? What impact has that had on artists, and is that likely to change either the law or police policy regarding vendors as, you know, people, you know, give their homes up to the bank and start selling their furniture on the sidewalk? I guess I could call it artistic if they whittle it a bit. I don't know.
Well, there's two different angles going there. As far as art sales, obviously, people losing their homes, losing their jobs, it's certainly not going to help art sales. As far as more people coming to the street to do vending, that's inevitable when there's an economic downturn. If you think back to the Depression, there were millions of people in the United States on street corners selling apples after 1930. None of that was going on before then. So clearly, whether we're going to be in a recession or a depression, there's going to be a lot more people trying to take up street vending. What are cities going to do about it? Frankly, I don't think they're going to be able to do much about it. And if you look at the alternatives, if somebody is really in a desperate situation, they can't feed their kids, they can't pay their rent, which would you rather have them do? Sell their own items on the street or go and rob your house? I think most people would have to say, hey, I'd much rather them go out and do some semi-illegal street vending than rob my house or do a stick-up. So I don't think they're going to be able to do a whole lot about it. But certainly the prospects for successfully making a living selling art on the street are not going to be helped at all by the economic downturn.
So where can people go to get more information about what Artist has done, the organization that you are the prez of, and also how perhaps, though the New York Federal Court of Appeals decision isn't binding out here in California, it isn't necessarily one that will be ignored entirely by a federal court if the issue is raised out here.
Well, Artists in what's the beach area in L.A.?
Venice.
Venice Beach. Some artists took our lawsuit maybe 5-6 years ago and won a lawsuit there about that, which got rid of their license requirement. Then the city went, compromised some of those artists, and brought back a permit system. But that ruling still exists there. So theoretically, anybody in I think you're in the 9th district, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes.
Anybody in that federal district could take that Venice Beach case and basically go to their local authorities in whatever town or city that you're living in and say, look, here's the case law in our federal district. It says selling art on the street is protected by the First Amendment. And I think there's a fair chance that they'll convince them without a lawsuit to allow it. And if they don't allow it, then you have perfect grounds, very strong grounds, to file and to win that kind of lawsuit.
We actually had an artist, Mike True, a musician who was selling his audio art, his own music on the street. He was falsely arrested by one of our more notorious sergeants, Lauren Baker, who then was sued, and there was a settlement out of court, which was done for, I think, $15,000, $20,000, something like that. And so it has actually happened in Santa Cruz, perhaps citing the one in Venice Beach, because I think it happened just after that. It happened in the 2003, thereabouts.
And well, while most people don't feel too optimistic about defeating these license and permit requirements, I'll just relate to you another case that I won, which is it's called Letterman v. United States. In 98, I went to the steps of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. to give out leaflets about our issue because it was Arts Advocacy Day there, and there were going to be art advocates from all the museums and cultural institutions going to Congress and lobbying the congressmen to give more money to the arts. I said, let me drive to Washington give out some leaflets on the steps of the Capitol. In my naivete, I thought, where else would it be more open and free to give out a leaflet? What did they do? They arrested me for not having a permit. I sued. I won. I defeated the permit requirement for the steps of the U.S. Capitol. And this ruling took place after 9/11. And in the ruling, because it went to the appeals court in the District of Columbia.
It's still good law?
Excuse me?
It's still the law. There's no permit required?
It's still the law. Well, the appeals court in the District of Columbia ruled that even in light of 9/11, that it was not reasonable to require a permit to do protest activity or to give out leaflets on the steps. I'm talking on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. So I cite that as simply an indication, like a beacon to people anywhere in the country. Don't think it's going to be so impossible to win this issue. Because if you can give out a leaflet without a permit on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, it's very reasonable that you can display a few paintings on Main Street in whatever city you live without getting a permit.
We've got to get you to come to Santa Cruz, Robert. We had a situation where we went to the ACLU with a sign urging them to end the sleeping ban, and they tried to have me arrested for carrying that sign into a public meeting, they being the ACLU. So we may need some help from New York City.
Well, you know, one of the things that I discovered over the 14 years of doing this is that the official organizations, not going to name any names, but these organizations, because they depend on getting funding from very wealthy people, they tend to be compromised. They have the reputation of we're the advocates for the arts, we're the advocates for free speech, and they are, but they can only go so far. The beauty of my group is we take no funding from anybody. There's no dues to join. There's no requirements. We don't seek any grants. I've never sought a single penny in grant money from anywhere. And as a result, we do whatever we think is the right thing to do. We're totally we may do something that's not a great idea. We may make some mistakes. But we don't make mistakes because somebody paid us a lot of money and is telling us, no, you can't do this or you better do this. We do what we think is the right thing to do. And I would say to advocates all over the country that are in these kind of situations, when you take money from somebody, there are strings attached. And certainly we found here in our specific case that some of these advocacy groups, and again, I'm not going to name the names right now, but the most famous ones turned out to be the very people behind trying to have street artists arrested. Groups that were the very first people that we went to look for help. And then when they didn't help us, I did research into why they weren't helping us. And in some cases, the beauty of a lawsuit is you get to do discovery. You get the city to give you every document they have in their files about an issue, and you'd be amazed at some of the incriminating documents that we got, which showed exactly who was behind this crackdown. And it was the very people that would be the first names you would think of. Oh, you got a problem with this? Go to these people. They'll be the ones that'll help you.
Now, is there a reason now that you don't want to mention their names, even though they're now, you know, you found them out in discovery? Is it because... not because you're considering taking large donations from them, but rather because maybe you agree with what they do on other issues and you don't want to discourage people from supporting them. Like, for example, I support many of the things the National ACLU and the LA ACLU, which did the lawsuit that decriminalized homeless sleeping at night, and even the Santa Cruz ACLU on some issues, but of course it's not on local civil liberties issues generally. That's the problem. I'm just wondering why you feel reluctant to name names there, Robert Letterman.
More of a spiritual reason than any political or financial reason.
Huh.
And what I'm trying to communicate to your listeners is the principle that would apply anywhere rather than some specific embarrassing detail that's of no great use to them in Santa Cruz, for example. So knowing what art advocate in New York did something to us 10 years ago is not going to help them, but understanding the principle that maybe the very people that are the advocates are your worst enemies in your city, and it might not be the case. But believe me, I'm not saying it's always the case, but the principle I'm trying to communicate here is that, you know, don't always go to the people that the average person, that's the first name they come up with, as the person you're going to need to solve this problem.
So when you speak locally, though, Robert, you're not reluctant to name names of organizations that
No, of course not, because it's valid to give that information because we're actually dealing with those people on a daily basis. I'll name a name. Just so I already said Mike Bloomberg, who's probably the biggest art advocate in the United States right now, bigger than Ted Turner or anybody like that. He's got something like $30 billion. He gave $500 million to the arts just since he's been mayor. And now you can't get a bigger reputation as an art advocate than that. And yet we consider him public enemy number one for street artists right now. So he's certainly, he would be exactly the person somebody might say, oh, why don't you write a letter? And I do write to Bloomberg, and he writes back to me. We've talked about these things. But he is definitely not our friend. The Museum of Modern Art. Years ago when this issue first started, everybody would say to me, oh, just go to the Museum of Modern Art and ask them for help. Well, I went there, and not only did they refuse to help, but later on, I got a hold of letters that they were sending to elected officials telling them to arrest artists. So I'm not talking off the top of my head here. I have a lot of very specific facts and pieces of evidence.
Are artists still being arrested on the New York streets?
No, no.
When was the last such arrest that you remember?
The last arrest, apart from, you know, freak things where an artist got in a fight with somebody and the police arrested them,
but
as far as for selling art,
right.
As far as I know, I'm the last artist that got arrested. That was in 2001. It was right in front of Mayor Giuliani's office. That was the last arrest for not having a park permit. His office was in a park. And after that arrest, they didn't arrest another artist.
But on the other hand, you haven't been commissioned by Giuliani to do any more art, have you?
Well, he collected a lot of my work, unfortunately. Well, he did end up paying for it, but he certainly wasn't trying to.
Well, how can people view your art? Where can it be seen?
Well, are we talking about my political art or just my regular art?
Both.
Well, if you send me an email, like I said, at artistprez, artistprez, at gmail.com, I have a couple of websites with the art. I'll be happy to give people links to that. It's really hard to say it verbally, if you know what I mean.
Sure, I do.
But I'll be more than happy to share that information. And more importantly to me, I'll be very happy to give them the address of our website. And there, you can literally find every document you could ever want on the legal issues about selling art on the street. And those same documents obviously apply to street performers and so on. There's also an advocacy group in New York for street performers, and I have a link to their website on my site. So, for example, if you're a street musician, comedian, juggler, whatever it is, their website has specific court rulings about that, and I'll be happy to give that to anybody that writes to me.
The name of the group again is?
Artists Response to Illegal State Tactics.
And the name of the street performers group?
They have a brochure they give out called Know Your Rights. I just can't think of their name off the top of my head.
No problem. If people are interested in this, you can give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I'll remind you of Robert's email, and or I'll look it up myself for you or give you the information to do that. We've been talking with Robert Letterman of Artist, and indeed that is the aptly named which I'm about to say by Cracky, Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics. Well, it looks like it's been kind of boring for you since 2001 with all that lack of illegal state tactics. Things have gotten pretty mellow up there.
Well, to tell you the truth, I do miss the old days, and it was a lot more exciting when Giuliani was mayor, because one of the things we discovered was that having a colorful, flamboyant enemy is a fantastic advantage. Compared to Bloomberg, a guy who presents himself as an advocate for the arts, Giuliani was a much better opponent because he really brought everything into stark contrast.
Well, some people had the same theory about Bush, but the problem was, if you looked at their Get Out of Iraq plans, you couldn't find a lot of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Because
I hear you.
Yeah. Well, let's leave that one for another day, hopefully tomorrow, if not tonight. And thank you, Robert, for coming on. I'll give you the last minute to sum up, which you're always eloquent and, you know, feel like giving us a little final eloquence due.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm 57 years old, and I lived most of my life without this. I had heard of the First Amendment, certainly, had no appreciation for what an invaluable thing the First Amendment was. I didn't start appreciating my First Amendment rights until the city of New York tried to take them away from me. And that's when I suddenly realized, in a very tangible way, what the First Amendment meant and how vital it was to my life, not only as an American, but as an artist. And I would highly recommend to your listeners to get a book or go online and do some research about the First Amendment. Even if they think they already know about it, I guarantee that it'll give them an awful lot of inspiration.
Thank you, Robert. And the show is going to be archived in case you want to hear yourself talk at www.huffsantacruz, H-U-F-F, Santa Cruz, all one word, all small letters, .org. Plus, there are some earlier shows of yours, which we have yet to properly label, but they're there somewhere, buried among our past broadcasts. Thank you for calling in. Thank you for doing what you do. And if anything new happens you think deserves some publicity, send me an email, and I'll announce it on Free Radio.
I will, and thanks very much for the opportunity to be on your show.
Hey, thanks, Robert. And that was Robert Letterman of Artist. That's Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics, from New York City, talking about his successful struggle to restore the First Amendment in response to the illegal police raids or unconstitutional police raids of former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. And I guess maintaining that throughout the Bloomberg regime, which is now going on. You think things have been pretty quiet for a while. This is Free Radio you're listening to, 101.1 FM. And www.freakradio.org. My name is Robert Norse, and this is a twice-weekly show, which you can also, I guess the best way to hear it is to go on the computer if you're out of the area, again, freakradio.org, or to download an old show just for the heck of it. We've got hundreds of them. And, hey, enjoy. I spend a lot of time with street interviews because people on the streets need to be heard, and they don't get heard much. And what they are talking about, particularly since I'm directing the conversation by directing the interviews, is what I want to – essentially, I am in sympathy with seeing changed, namely laws that criminalize poor and homeless people. But before we get back to the more serious stuff, here's a little more music from Uncle Banzai for you.
This is another one of our requests. This is, I don't know how many years you've been seeing Uncle Banzai, some of you, but quite a few years ago we used to do one song of every musical genre. We had a country song and a reggae song and a blues song and a lounge song, and we had some stupid songs. We had a minuet, that's right. We had a xylophone song. We had a helium song.
We had a polka.
We had
that was my favorite.
The helium, we don't have any. Thank you. This song is our one jazz song.
Yeah.
We were all jazz musicians before we were in Banzai, and this is the only chance that we all had to actually riff on our instruments. So there's actually a jazz solo in the middle. Please hold your applause to the end, or just hold your applause. What the hell, you know?
This song is called In the Suburbs.
In the suburbs of your life, warm, caring memories, clipping coupons with your wife, bulk buying groceries, teach your own morality, border on banality, field trips, nose trips, family finality. In the suburbs have affairs, mom's in therapy, sleepless nights been setting snares, how unfair. motherly. Dad and Janie from next door. Mommy called her friend a whore. Swing set, sex swap. Now we move to Baltimore. Carpool vans
in the suburbs.
Meet in cans
in the suburbs.
Social bands and baby boom. No one's gay
in the suburbs.
Déjeuner
in the suburbs.
Living life in living rooms. In the suburbs, lawn displays neon nativity. Plastic Negro points the way condescendingly. Learn to like your neighbor's boy. Buy him an explosive toy. Pop goes weasel. Now we have to move to Troy. Mass produce
in the suburbs.
Self-abuse
in the suburbs.
Overuse and oversell. Nights are bright
in the suburbs.
Right is right
in the suburbs.
Neighbor kids made by Mattel.
And that was, of course, In the Suburbs, Uncle Banzai. And if you want to call in, you can. You might have some thoughts about what Robert Letterman said over the last hour and 15 minutes. The phone number here is 427-3772, 427-FRSC, for those not numerically inclined. 427-3772, and I will answer, and you can talk on the air if you'd like. I'm going to move now to those street interviews. I guess I'll just do that, and we'll see what happens here. There's a couple of good ones, some substantial ones. See what you think. And if you have comments or calls, don't have to wait until the end of the interview. If you want to call in during the interview, I will take your call off air, and if I feel like it, I'll interrupt the interview, and I often do because I try to give precedence to callers. So 427-3772 is the number to call.
Down on Pacific Avenue, Saturday night, the 22nd of March, across from the Cinema 9, and we're talking with Mike Jolson. And Mike, you're a petition man. You have this table and a fistful of petitions and some sort of cafe chile or something. So what's cooking with the petition, and something to do with hemp?
Most of the listeners are probably familiar with it, but we're the California Cannabis Hemp and Health Initiative for 2008, and we have basically two main goals: to end the prohibition for personal consumption, just like wine. That's one of the main goals. And the second goal is to re-legalize cannabis hemp so we can make all the products out of it for industrial use. So personal use, just like wine, and for industrial use. And we've only got just less than a month here in California to garnish all the signatures. So we're trying to desperately get people to do what they can to help us. And we want to thank everyone that has signed our initiative as well.
Well, I remember Measure K 2 years ago in Santa Cruz was supposed to be kind of a precursor to a state initiative that made it the lowest enforcement priority. Tell me another one in the Santa Cruz area. But there was and passed in also two other cities in California, kind of replicating the Oakland Measure Z initiative and also a successful Seattle initiative, which apparently actually had an enforcement mechanism, unlike the Santa Cruz one, which was neutered by the by a deal between Ben Rice and the city attorney in May of last year. But at the state level, is there actually anything that is going to tax and regulate marijuana cultivation, possession, transportation, sales, et cetera?
Well, that's okay. Our initiative, good question. Our initiative is different than the citywide Measure K, but it's very similar. Our initiative is to do exactly that. It's to tax and regulate consumption on a commercial basis.
But not like sales, like, transportation.
No, sales.
Cultivation.
Cultivation. Basically, it would allow everyone, without a note, so you could grow 12 pounds, personal use, and then anything over that you get taxed is commercial production. Mm-hmm. And so you get a permit for $30 downtown as you do wine, and you can become a commercial producer, and then you get taxed on that. So, yeah, we are exactly all about tax and regulating cannabis, mm-hmm. But like the wine model. And what happened with the Measure K crew, the folks, was that they did a poll statewide, and it didn't favor their wording, which would to make marijuana lowest police priority or to tax and regulate small amounts. But whereas our wording is 100% different, because we're talking about growing hemp as a paper, as a fuel, as a fiber, and tax and regulating. So we're bringing a big environmental picture into the crowd, which seems to yield more signatures from my experience, because there's a lot of middle-of-the-road people that support hemp paper, hemp fiber, hemp fuel, especially when we explain that we're not going to do it through the legislature because Schwarzenegger keeps on vetoing the hemp bill.
Now, are we talking only about hemp or about marijuana as well?
Well,
hemp, of course, is the non-cannabis-active aspect of marijuana.
Yeah, this initiative is wonderful because it is combining both. It's like I had said, it's combining smoking cannabis, tax and regulating it, just like wine. And it's also about growing hemp as a so it's both. It's combining both. It's not leaving anyone out of the picture in the marijuana reform movement as far as any special interest. This is bringing everything together, and that's why it's a wonderful initiative.
Who's funding the initiative?
At the moment, we're 100% volunteer, and we're hoping members of one of the biggest hip-hop bands from the old school, Bone Thugs and Harmony, separate from their record, their album, are going to make a CD coming out to benefit our initiative. And I believe their acronym's going to be LDT, which means Lazy Bone, Dre Ghost, and Thin C. They're three of the members of the Bone Thugs. And Hip Hop for Hemp is their website. Hip Hop for Hemp is, the attitude is to get hip-hop artists in the hip-hop community that sings about smoking and likes to smoke the herb to do something about it and actually legalize it and promote hemp as a fiber, as a fuel. So these guys are getting on board. We're hoping that this CD can come out in time. But anyway, they're going to put out a 10-song CD. The first song, Holla, Holla If You Feel Me, I can get you a copy to play.
Cool.
And it's the first song called Holler If You Feel Me, and it talks about alcohol is legal, but cannabis isn't. And we can make fuel, and we don't need to have hunger, and we don't need war when we can make hemp for fuel. And
yeah, but what are our police departments going to do with the decreased funding and the need to occupy themselves with activity?
Yeah, the California Police Officers Association is one of the larger, more powerfully influential organizations, and that is one force. The biggest force probably against even hemp being grown, industrial hemp. So it's true. Our quest is, we only have about a solid month left to gather all these signatures, and appreciate all the listeners out there that have
500,000 signatures, right?
Yeah, we need 434,000 valid signatures.
Which is about 600,000 or 700,000
yeah,
signatures.
You got it, yep.
You have about 50,000 now, or?
Well, we're probably estimated somewhere between
200,000.
Almost 200,000. But our problem is we can't get a solid number because it's scattered through professional organizers throughout the state that are sort of waiting for the money to come in to give us better count.
Wasn't this in the 2006 version funded by some out-of-state money?
Mm-hmm.
Some wealthy, enlightened individual who wanted to change the drug war laws?
Yeah, and that was in 1996. The Medical Marijuana Initiative was similar, but actually we're even bigger now.
The 2006... The three small measures in the cities, Santa Cruz, Santa Monica, and was it West Hollywood, or Santa Barbara, I guess it was.
Okay.
I mean, there was money that was funded each of these city initiatives, right?
Those city initiatives were funded by an organization called MPP, Marijuana Policy Project, and they're out of D.C., and they are funded. They have some, you know, wealthy funders, so that, yeah, it was not, I don't think last minute it was funded, but it was definitely funded, and MPP isn't funding our initiative. I wish.
Why not?
Well, I think they have limited resources, but
I thought they just hold these smaller initiatives in 2006 at a city level were a step toward the larger 2008 initiative.
Yeah, and their initiative for 2008 would have been completely different than ours, because see, ours is about growing hemp for paper, fiber, and fuel.
As well
And as well as tax and regulating, and that might be too radical for...
Tax and regulating that which is not for paper and fuel, but rather for smoking and ingesting and recreational use.
All respect to MPP, they're doing wonderful things. I think our initiative, I know they're in support, you know, intellectually, but financially, we sure could use their or anyone's support. We have three websites with a PayPal donation button.
Why don't you tell us what they are?
Okay, the youthfederation.com, so Y-U-T-H federation.com, and then we got Cal...
Y-O-U or Y-U?
Y-O-U.
Uh-huh.
And then we have calhemp08.org, that's calhemp08.org, and you will be able to see, basically, if people can give $20, you know, $30-$40, that money will go to pay signature gatherers, and that's what we're trying to desperately do, is raise the money so we can pay these professionals that are out on the street, but they're not getting paid. Mm-hmm. They're hoping they will, and so that's our kind of end.
No donation is too much.
No donation is too much.
And we're speaking with
Dan Cooper,
signature gatherer or signature coordinator extraordinaire.
I run a crew, yes, of petitioners, and we're doing the hemp, cannabis hemp petition.
As well as a number of others.
Yeah, prison reform. There's two renewable energy policy petitions, a victims' rights petition, and one on redistricting done by or sponsored by Common Cause, League of Women Voters, and AARP.
Dan's the state coordinator of our initiative, the California Hemp Initiative. Dan has played a wonderful role, his tireless energy.
He's being well paid, of course.
Well paid. He's making 0 cents per hour, and I mean, that's a hard rate to beat.
Why don't you double his salary?
Yeah. And so, I mean, Dan Cooper, love you, and it's like his heart is really into this, and he's spread this initiative throughout the state on a professional level. So all we're looking for is the gasoline to light, or the match to light the fire, really, because once we could raise the money throughout the state, we could turn California on fire in regard to growing hemp and getting the petitioners to make it their top petition rather than their last one.
The deadline is?
The last day we could physically probably gather signatures, ironically, is on 4/20. April 20th.
My goodness.
So I have one. I love making up slogans, but I have a real good slogan for this. We're trying to take the boogeyman out of pot, and so it's the slogan is Happy 420. So Happy 420.
Happy 420. You know, one question I always ask when I see signature gatherers is, who is funding this particular effort? And every signature gatherer I've asked, not about this particular petition, but other petitions, doesn't know shit from shinola. They say, I don't know, you know, I'm circulating, and they give the name of an organization sort of that's circulating the petition, but not who's the money behind it? Where's, you know, who has made the most substantial donations? I would encourage you in the future to do a little research on each of these petitions so that you can give your petition circulators this information so that when someone like myself comes up to them and says, you know, is this another piece of bullshit being circulated by some conservative interest masquerading as a liberal petition? You know, the person can say, well, here are the organizations who contributed the most money to this effort. And that might require a little research, but I know a man of your diligence and your authority and your experience could do that.
Well, you probably were talking to another coordinator's people, because I train my people to tell what sponsors there are, and I do my research. But the problem is, it's not really a problem, is that we've run out of unique names for these committees, groups, coalitions. So any petition except ones that are done by the sponsor is like one person, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. They're usually groups, coalitions, committees to do what the petition says. So it's fairly safe to say this petition is a committee to do redistricting, as an example.
Yeah, but the question is this something that will be overturning a more liberal measure in the legislature?
Exactly.
Is it something that will be, you know, a duplication of another initiative that's different
example,
but not so good?
And a good example of that, Dan has more of an ethical spine. But there is, for instance, an anti-gang initiative to build more jails or harsher penalties, and that. But there's people carrying that one, and then the one for a victim for less jail time. So it's funny because hell.
How about no jail time? Yeah. Nobody's got that petition.
So I hear what you're saying, and because I've witnessed it firsthand as a one initiative person myself.
The marijuana petition this petition would let out 27,000 people on simple possession charges, which is like an immediate solution to overcrowding in jail.
You know, this marijuana petition sounds like it hasn't got a fart's chance in hell of going anywhere, given the huge number of signatures you need in a short amount of time. Not that it doesn't deserve, you know, a couple million dollars suddenly being pumped into it from some source. And even if it got that, I don't know how you could possibly get 500,000, 600,000 signatures in less than a month.
Actually, we're ready. We're ready to go.
In what respect?
All the petitioners, or not quite all the petitioners in the state, have our petition in hand right now.
Well, that may well be, but how many, on the average, how many signatures, how many petitioners are we talking about?
I've seen statewide petitions done in 2 weeks.
Give me an example.
I can't give you an example because I just
don't
have it in my head right now.
But it's, check out, just for the listeners, the website Hip Hop for Hemp, because soon that's how you can find this new CD. This idea of the CD, and I mean, I agree, this is going to be a miracle from somewhere above,
now,
most likely.
Neil Coonerty will help us out.
Exactly. Yeah, he's been extremely sympathetic. But
really?
No, I'm just joking.
Well, he's our supervisor.
And his son is extremely excited about it as well.
Ryan Coonerty, our mayor.
No, just joking too. But he's clicking his heels.
He's a supervisor over here.
He's clicking his heels for it. But this album could be a source of revenue. But Dan, like the analogy is, if we could get the money, we could potentially do this, because our initiative is a wedge for all these other. They stop people with ours to get signatures for the others.
And Santa Cruz.
No.
No, statewide.
Statewide. Yeah.
Okay, well,
it's a petition that
I'm not going to spend my time bad-mouthing your chances, though. I think, as I said, it sounds like a very, very long, long shot.
The person that they're talking to is saying, what'd you say, son? What'd you say? That's you know, the reaction is when a petitioner says sign for marijuana,
right.
To legalize marijuana, they go, what? And it's not a boring topic.
Have you gotten any endorsements from any major show business figures, politicians, martyrs, or Iraqi vets, returning murderers?
No, that's what we need. We need the Woody Harrelsons and the Bill Maher's and the Larry Flint's, but we don't have them. We do have, like I said, we got some potential hip-hop artists who sold 43 million albums. But no, we don't have any Hollywood Leonardo DiCaprios or, you know, these green Hollywood celebrities. However,
wait a minute, didn't Arnie Schwarzenegger say he was going to light up for light up with Arnie 2003?
The endorsements are in the campaign phase anyway. In the petitioning time, it's not time for endorsements, and that's we're in the petitioning time. So if we get on the ballot, then that's the time for the endorsements to come forward.
Well, it's time for me to be a wandering on. I've been talking with
Mike Jolson
and
Dan Cooper.
And again, the website to you to look for, as well as, of course, the table across from the Cinema 9, what, once a week, twice a week, every day?
It should be here every day. Dan will set it up. But youthfederation.com and calhemp, calhemp08.org.
Okay.
So Youth Federation, that's easy because it means world democracy. Youth Federation, global consciousness, world democracy
is here.
Is what we're trying to make. Human rights on Earth, on one planet, precious planet Earth. Happy spring to everyone, 2008.
Human rights in Santa Cruz would be a good idea, too,
sure
while
we're
at it. Thank you very much, guys.
We hope everyone, you know, survives this economic downslide.
Oh, well, just give up your home now before the bank takes your home and your money. Thank you. We're talking...
Well, we're not talking to anybody, but you could be talking to me if you are able to survive the blips and bleeps of this broadcast, which I'm told have been plaguing it for the last hour and a half. My apologies to everybody out there. You can get a fresh, minty, crisp, clear, hopefully clear, version of this broadcast by going to the Huff website. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and it's www.huffsantacruz.org. And then you click on the name of the show, which is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. And then you click on the date, and there you are. It may take a day, however, for the show to come your way. If you want to hear it as we're going, if you're listening to your radio, you happen to be at home and you have a computer, you can turn on your computer to freakradio.org, which we are streaming on right now. www.freak, F-R-E-A-K-R-A-D-I-O, freakradio.org. And you'll actually be able to hear this thing without those fits and starts that I understand are startling and causing us fits, at least causing me some discomfort as I hear about it. Sorry about all that. I don't know what the problem is, and hopefully it will not be interfering with the next show, which is a musical show, which will be even more unusual to hear if it's getting the blip-blip treatment. So I'm looking at a set... at a website, I should say, Alternet, which probably some of you are familiar with, and they have a lot of articles on the war in Iraq. One of the most recent ones is called Handed Over to a Government Called Sadr by Dar Jamal and Ali al-Fadili, IPS News, and it's posted today. Despite the huge media campaign led by U.S. officials and a complicit corporate-controlled media, to convince the world of U.S. success in Iraq, emerging facts on the ground show massive failure. The date March 25th of this year will be remembered as the day of truth through 5 years of occupation. Mehdi army militias controlled all Shia and mixed parts of Baghdad in no time, a Baghdad police colonel speaking on condition of anonymity told IPS. Iraqi army and police forces, as well as Badr and Dawa militias, suddenly disappeared from the streets, leaving their armored vehicles for Mehdi militiamen to drive around in joyful convoys. That toured many parts of Baghdad before taking them to their stronghold in Sadr City in the east of Baghdad. The police colonel was speaking of the recent clashes between members of the Shia Muqtada al-Sadr's Mehdi army, the largest militia in Iraq, and members of the Iraqi government forces that are widely known to comprise members of a rival Shia militia, the Badr organization. Dozens of militiamen from both sides were killed in clashes that broke out in Baghdad, Basra, Kut, Samawa, Hilla, and most of the Iraqi Shia southern provinces between the Mehdi army and other militias such as the Badr organization, supported by the U.S., Iran, and the Iraqi government, a strange coalition of supporters. The Badr organization militia is headed by Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, who is also head of the Supreme Islamic Iraqi Council, or SIIC, SIC for short, that dominates the Iraqi government. The Dawah Party is headed by Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The number of civilians killed and injured in the clashes is still unknown. Iraqi government offices continue to keep largely silent about the events. Every resident of Basra knew the situation would explode any minute between these oil thieves and that Basra would suffer another wave of militia war. Salman Kathum, a doctor and former resident of Basra who fled for Baghdad last month, told IPS. For months now, there has been a struggle between the Sadr movement, the SIC, that's the government militias, the Supreme Islamic Iraqi Council, and the Al-Fadila Party for control of the south, and particularly Basra. Fala Shenshal, an MP allied to al-Sadr, told Al Jazeera March 26th that al-Maliki was targeting political opponents. They say that they target outlaw gangs, but why do they start with the areas where the Sons of the Sadr movement are located? This is a political battle for the political interests of one party, al-Maliki's Dawah Party, because the local elections are coming soon, due later this year. And I'm going to pause, and actually I'm going to stop reading this particular article, because it's, I think, a little hard for folks who aren't familiar with the situation of the different warring parties in Iraq to really understand through a first reading. I'd like to kind of simplify it to pass on what I've picked up from the conflict in Iraq in the last week by reading various mostly leftist sources. I won't say almost exclusively leftist sources, but this is what I picked up anyway. There's been a massive escalation of violence in Iraq because the government, the Iraqi government, funded by the U.S. and led by a guy named Prime Minister al-Maliki, wants to move on the movement of Muqtada al-Sadr, who is not a terrorist, who is not even a Sunni Ba'athist, a person from the previous Saddam Hussein government. He's not a foreign Iranian agent. He's just, you know, he's a local Shiite cleric who's actually well-regarded by many, many people in Iraq who are Shiites of his faction. And he's formed this kind of a private militia which protects the communities he lives in and no doubt exploits them too to some extent probably, supplies basic public services, security, and so forth, and actually fought the U.S. government to a standstill in Fallujah back in 2004, but has been since declaring a ceasefire because he wants the U.S. out of Iraq, but he wants to do so by political means, if possible. And so his party has the largest number of seats in the government. But, of course, they don't control the government. The government is controlled by, because they don't have a majority, they have the largest number of a bunch of different parties. Instead, the party that controls the government is a coalition of other Shiite Iraqis. And I remind folks that Iraq is divided into Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds in the main. The Christians have been driven out. I guess there's a smaller Turkish minority and so forth. But the main groups are those. But the Shiites are the majority group, and that was a group oppressed by Saddam Hussein and that tried to rebel in the early 1990s. And the elder Bush promised them support and then pulled it away, and they got creamed by Saddam Hussein. What President Bush has been trying to do is put a rosy face on what's right now a political battle between the main government of Iraq, which is, the prime minister is not really elected there. He's a coalition guy who has been formed, who is sort of in power almost by default. There were elections held in 2005, but the elections' main groups did not participate because they felt the elections were phony, and now they're looking forward to the elections of 2008. And in anticipation of a victory in the South by the group that I mentioned, Muqtada al-Sadr's group, the government group run by al-Maliki, the prime minister, wants to, at least some people believe, and I tend to think this is credible, wipe them out or drive them away or make the people believe they can't be protected by them by eliminating them as a rival militia while claiming they're going after all militias in Iraq. Now, if that were true, they'd also be going after the Badr Brigades, which are the militia of one of the main governing parties of Iraq. And the difference between the militias and the government troops are the militias are independent armies run by political parties. The government troops are the ones that are supposed to be neutral. They're supposed to include Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds. They're fighting on behalf of the whole government, not on behalf of one faction. But in fact, the government is controlled by one faction, and is that faction is also very subservient to the United States. I don't know if anybody's interested in that, but that is what I kind of have gleaned from the situation. And I also, if I can get this computer to behave properly, noted a couple things. The media, the mainstream media, the Sentinel, the San Francisco Chronicle, mainstream news, is trying to portray the violence in Iraq as a struggle between the Iraqi government and the terrorists. But, in fact, what's happening is a struggle between two factions that are actually both opposed to al-Qaeda, if you want to regard them as the terrorists, though, of course, the major terrorists in the world today aren't al-Qaeda, but they're the United States, which is killing more people than al-Qaeda could ever hope to kill. At least that's my view, and that seems to be also, I think, justified by the facts. We have a caller. Maybe we can get another perspective. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I just want to say that the pauses are the best part of tonight's show.
Right? Oh, thank you. You're so sweet. The two of us will be pausing together.
I'll listen.
You'll try to listen.
You bet.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not the pauses, of course. It's the you've got to get yourself a computer, folks, if you can. And anyway, there's only 10 minutes left of this jerky show, and so I think if I put on music, it'll really be horrible. So I'm gonna spare you that. You can try to understand what I'm saying, or perhaps just go out and get dinner somewhere. That might be a better idea. Here's General William Odom speaking to the U.S. Senate. He's a general that opposed the surge, as President Bush called his escalation of 30,000 troops over the last year. Rather than paying attention to the American public and withdrawing troops, he's, of course, escalated. Ditto with the Democrats in the House, who talk against the war but won't stop the funding for it. What General Odom says is, take note of the al-Qaeda public diplomacy campaign over the past year or so on internet blogs. They, al-Qaeda, implore the United States to bomb and invade Iran and destroy this apostate Shiite regime. As an aside, it gives me pause to learn that our vice president and some members of the Senate are aligned with al-Qaeda on spreading the war to Iran. It's interesting. This is the first I'd heard that al-Qaeda was actually backing a war against Iran. I can believe it, but I haven't verified that. But that's an interesting claim by General William Odom speaking to the U.S. Senate, and that's from antiwar.org. That's a selection from his speech from, I think, was yesterday or the day before. He was speaking against the Bush General Petraeus surge that's going on in Iraq. There has been a truce between Muqtada al-Sadr, who, as I said, is the guy with the most people in a political party of the Shiite groups, but not the person who is in the government. He actually took his legislators out of the government, left the cabinet. He was in the government before in opposition and protest when al-Maliki's government refused to respond to claims that they've been engaging in death squad activities against their Sunni rivals and against Muqtada al-Sadr Shiite rivals. And so there was a truce for a long period of time, but a lot of Muqtada al-Sadr's lieutenants found that the al-Maliki's government was arresting them anyway, so, you know, why not stand up and just say no? So for a week there's been a resistance, to a successful resistance in Basra and other cities to al-Maliki's and the government troops backed by U.S. firepower. And then Iran, according to this latest news story from, I think it's from the AP, brokered a new truce between al-Maliki and Muqtada al-Sadr. The truce already broken by al-Maliki with more arrests without warrant of Muqtada al-Sadr's forces. So again, strange situation where the Bush likes to portray Iran as the bad guy and the Iraqi government as the good guy. It's actually the Iranian government is, you call it bad or good, it is a player in the Middle East, and what it's doing is it's actually closer to the Iraqi government, and they have closer ties. After all, one of the main parties that's in the Iraqi government fled to Iran and stayed there for 20 years until Saddam Hussein was overthrown. And indeed, Muqtada al-Sadr is the nationalist, so-called, called anti-American, but he actually just wants U.S. troops out. And he's told his soldiers to stand down for the last year. There's been this truce with American troops. Hard to say whether he's biding his time, waiting for the government to collapse, waiting for an imaginary revolution in the United States, or just waiting until the people rise up themselves. Hard to say what he's waiting for. But he's had a truce with the rest of the particularly U.S. government forces. John McCain also recently said that he would support 100 years of troops in Iraq, spinning it by saying, well, he's talking about like South Korea and Kuwait. But it's been pointed out also that those countries weren't invaded by the U.S. The troops were invited in. The U.S. invaded and destroyed the Iraqi government. So significant difference there, and I thought I kind of noticed as I read this. And there's an interesting article by Juan Cole in Salon magazine online. He's also probably got it reprinted on his own website, Informed Comment. Juan Cole is a guy I don't always agree with. He's a little too conservative for my taste, but he's got some interesting analysis. He has a long article on why did the Iraqi prime minister attack the Mahdi army in Basra last week. And the only reason it's interesting to follow this is because you're getting so many lies and such a spin in the national media that it's important to counter that with a little understanding of what's really happening. What's really happening is civil war in Iraq between two Shiite factions, one of which controls the government and has U.S. firepower. And that same faction, strangely, is supported by Iran, which the U.S. is pumping up the war drums against. And strangely enough, at the same time, the U.S. is pumping up the war drums against Iran, so is Al-Qaeda. So it's a really strange rat's nest, hornet's nest, thorn bush, tar baby, I don't know what to call it. It's a murderous occupation of a foreign country that none of the candidates that's running for any of the big offices, and not even our local Emily Riley, I haven't heard her saying anything intelligible about this either. You might say, well, she's just the mayor, she's just running for the state assembly. Well, there are ways that mayors and people in the state assembly can show their opposition to the war in Iraq in a meaningful way by cutting off funding and investments and investigating where such funding is happening. And that's one thing Emily Riley has refused to do. I'm also just going to briefly mention that we are successfully proceeding on the sleeping band lawsuit. There has been a successful conference call with three attorneys in Washington, D.C., who are now going to be backing us on the East Coast. We have seven people signed up and eight more ready to sign up, signed contracts with attorneys to overturn the sleeping ban and finally make the city pay through the nose and stop its criminalization and harassment of the homeless. And you're going to be hearing more about it on this radio station. If you want to become a part of the lawsuit, if you want to be a supporter of the lawsuit, if you want to support the struggle, the homeless resistance, I call it, you can give a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and the number is easy to remember, 423-HUF, 423-4833. I also invite you to come to the Human Rights Organization meeting on Saturday. That's at the Firefly Cafe at 2 o'clock, 131 Front Street. I don't think there's going to be another protest in parking lot 27 this Friday. I think that Andreas, the guy who did that protest and was given a citation under the parking lot panic law, is still biding his time. But he has told me in an email that he wants to get another protest going as soon as he can get a sufficient number of students involved, and as soon as he's covered the legal logistics of his current citation. And we'll see what he does. Perhaps we can have him call in a report in a future show. I really apologize for the jerks, the blips, the clicks, and express my amazement and admiration to all you listeners out there who... Sorry, I'm strangling myself, who are listening to this in spite of the technical difficulties. I'll be back on Sunday. Hopefully you'll actually be able to hear the show. And now you may turn your radio off as I play the goodbye music, because I don't think you're going to like it much. But for the purpose of those listening in the stream, it might be kind of enjoyable. You never can tell. Thanks for being with me on this edition, such as it was, of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
Yeah, I was of...
I think we better wait on that one.
Thanks a lot.
Too many faces strange in the morning, too many breakfasts while somebody breaks, too many body strokes like a fixture, too many fakers and too many flakes, too many moments led to the pasture, too many movements while somebody sleeps, too many virgins and lambs to the slaughter, too many Christians and too many creeps. Where is the justice? Where's the madness? Where is the twinge of jealousy? Where are the endless mornings after? Where is the one for me? Too many cowards dressed for the courting, too many jokers while somebody weeps, too many idiots for boils and spotted, too many critics and too many creeps. Where is the justice? Where's the madness? Where is the twinge of jealousy? Where are the endless mornings after? Where is the one for me? Too many faces strange and deserting, too many lovers while somebody leaps, too many faces huddled and hurting, too many criminals, too many creeps.
Too many faces huddled and hurting,
too many criminals, too many creeps.
This one is about college boys, the sort of freshman, sophomore, mostly freshman age group, the slightly post-pubescent, rabid young men. You may have come across one or two in your experience. You always know them by how they respond when a woman walks by them, because it's as if the woman were wafting pheromones.
They sit up straight real fast, don't they?
They sit up. They do all kinds of things real fast.
We'd like to call our next album Uncle Bonsai.
Industrial disease. Caretaker was crucified.
cough from smoking, brewers droop from drinking beer. I don't know how you came to get the Betty Davis knees, but worst of all, young man, you've got a lung for your disease. He wrote me a prescription, he said, you are depressed. I'm glad you came to see me to get this off your chest. Come back and see me later. Next patient, please. Send me another victim of industrial disease. Ah! Splendid. And I go down to Speaker's Corner. I'm a thunderstruck. They got free speech tourists.
Well, I certainly hope folks are enjoying the show so far. Unfortunately, Free Radio is currently experiencing some technical difficulties in our broadcast signal. If there are any Free Radio people out there who could go to the transmitter and reset it, that would be great. And for the rest of you who are listening on the stream, that apparently is working quite well. Anyway, you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org, no matter what is happening. That's what you're tuned to. I just hope you can stand it. I'm Uncle Dennis, and from 8 to 11, it's From the Cream to the Dregs. And we're going to continue right on with the music until our Brew of the Week comes up in just a few minutes. So stay tuned.
Ramma, lamma, fa, fa, fa. Starts out with Brother Wayne Kramer. Brother Wayne Kramer.